All right, welcome to this edition of Firefighting Fridays. This is Strategic Fire Training. I'm Jeff Diedrich, and I have Chad Groover, John Mateer, Jeff Shoup, and Micah Heideman. Riding shotgun with Micah Heideman tonight is Dean Edward, Micah's new arrival. So welcome to the show, son.
2 weeks old.
All right, we'll keep it. We'll have to keep his questions short and sweet. All right, Micah.
All right, I'll try and pass them through.
Nothing yeah, he's going to put some time into business before he starts talking up.
Right.
He's got a ways to go.
The new guy better keep his mouth shut and his ears open.
That's right.
All right. So tonight we've got a different approach for us for the show. We're going to go over a large scale incident that Shoup was involved with back in the early 2000s. But some things are timeless. One of those things is experience based information. So, Jeff, can you lead us off here and kind of give us a what's what on this building and this incident, and then we'll move into the first alarm and onward from there.
Okay. Well, first of all, take a look at the picture and you see that the weather conditions were conducive, to good clear operations, except for the heavy smoke condition. And this is early on in the incident, and this building was being demoed. And this is one in a series of buildings back in this area right here. And they were being demoed to make way for future redevelopment or whatever along a main drag, Euclid Avenue in Cleveland. And what happened was there was cutting operations taking place in the building. And there was a demo crew in the basement cutting a pipe out of a wall, about a 4-inch diameter pipe. And as they cut it with the hot cutting devices, happened to be a live natural gas feed. When you have a big industrial complex, they will bring it in a large pipe like that. And then the other pipelines to feed the other gas appliances would come off of that. Well, guess what? You got a 4-inch supply line bringing in all that natural gas. So they call the fire department and crews get there. They stretch a line in. And of course, with that kind of situation, you take a line in, but it's going to be requiring a couple of lines. And by the time you get a couple of lines stretched, you might be in a situation where you're just playing catch up at that point, taking into account the type of construction. Again, this is a very old building, and that's where the outside color of the building, the beige and the brown colors, you'd look at that, you'd think, oh, this isn't a old building. It's a middle-aged building or something like that. But no, this is a very, very old building. Timber and ordinary combination, it can be a fooler. And it's like that thing that we were just talking about before going on the air here about, it's like putting perfume on a pig. It's still a pig underneath. It may have a different look, but it's still what it is underneath. So that's what you got here, a very, very old industrial building. And again, they scrap them out. They cut out all the scrappable material before they go and finish the demoing. And that allows a fire like this to get into the wall spaces, the shaft ways and things like that. And you have rapid fire spread. So that's when you guys who have had your experiences in buildings like these under demolition, you realize you're at much of a disadvantage, on arrival. So, but anyways, we're going to take you through the series of photos here.
What we're looking at there is like an AD corner and or a 1-4 corner, right?
This is actually the backside.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, this is the backside. This is 46th Street, where you see the three firefighters walking that way.
Yeah,
they're walking towards the main drag, which is Euclid Avenue.
Okay, so it's essentially a two-story, ordinary constructed timber frame building here, huh?
Yes, part of it timber, part of it ordinary.
And so what are the overall dimensions? Are we like this is 1 by 200, 3 by 400? Or?
Oh, God. Well, it's half a city block long.
Okay.
This particular building. You'll see as we move around in the photos, the other buildings that were interconnected to it.
All right.
So it created, you know, again, a real concern, because that's the other thing, you know, whenever you run into a fire of this nature, we talk about having all the voids open and things like that where the fire can get into and spread quickly, but also the location of fire within the building. And so if you have atmospheric conditions that, you know, like wind conditions or something like that, that can blow a fire through a building like this, as you can see, the windows are still in on this side right here. So they hadn't gotten to the point, I mean, the demo people hadn't gotten to the point where they'd removed the windows. So,
okay.
You want me to move on here?
Yeah, let's go to the next slide. And when you do so, what was the initial assignment to the alarm?
Well, this is an area, it's old commercial and industrial, and it's the 4600 block of Euclid Avenue in Cleveland, and it's a 3-2-1, you know, back, okay. You know, three engines, two trucks, and a squad company going in. You can see here, you get an idea, this is 46 to the right, and then you have that tactical unit right there, and then that tower ladder there on Euclid Avenue. And they're pointing eastbound. So, again, the fire started in this end of the building right here in the basement. And you can see how it's moved quickly up through. Because you see, look at the left side of the nest building. It's not there yet, but it's coming quick. Down on the other end of that building is a four-story commercial right there. But it's kind of deceiving the way you look at the end of the building that's on fire, and then that four-story in between there, sandwiched in between there, is an occupied four-story hotel, and it sits back. And so, you know, again, the concern is, you know, the fire service, you know, what are we all about? You know, saving lives and property. So in this case, you know, we had the life safety factor, I think, pretty much under control. It was saving the property at this point. So we know the fire's got a good hold of this building that's been opened up and so forth, scrapped out, and now it's moving quickly and going down the block eastward. So
gotcha.
So okay. Anyway, oh, by the way, one of the things about Euclid Avenue, you know, this was fortunate at the time and the location. And this goes for anybody who has a fire of major proportions. Where's your water coming from? Well, again, you know, this has two water mains. One's a 48-inch water main, and the other one is a 36-inch water main that go right along Euclid Avenue. They go through Cleveland, and they go out through the eastern suburbs into the eastern highlands. So because Cleveland water goes out all over the place. But water supply really wasn't a concern here. You know, if anything, you know, it's getting enough apparatus and heavy streams in operation, you know, because we certainly had the water to supply it.
Okay.
So you see a deck gun operation right now, and then you're seeing the tower ladder get ready to go into, you know, business. So.
All right.
So. Okay, so once again, it's moving through the building from right to left, going right down the block. And now, as you can see, it's up into that roof area, that cockloft area. And it's, you know, a different color smoke than what's coming out of the windows or the walls or something like that. Now you get that black, heavy roofing material that's burning and so forth. So it's not an idea, you know, and when you look back at this fire, as many years ago, and that's why I love having the photographer that we had. Steve Nedrich has done great work over the years documenting our work. Yeah, we always call him our official, unofficial department photographer. But, you know, you get to study these things and watch them and what we did back then. And this goes for any department, you know, about, you know, you're chronicling your work here, you know. And as you can see, you look at what happened here, and you know, you look back and think, yeah, that was it at the time. That's what we could do at that point. You got a fire that's rapidly moving, you know, throughout a building, and if you don't slow it down, stop it, or cut off the fuel, you know, you got a few options there. But if you don't employ one or more of those options, it's going to go down the block and it's going to wipe out a couple more buildings, and we don't want to do that. So you got to get things in position early on. And that's why when I used to read one of my early heroes' work, you know, Leo Stapleton out of Boston, and he would talk about, you know, rapid succession and stage them. Just get them in there, get the forces in there quickly, and then figure out where you need them so they don't all respond in. You get a big parking lot picture with all these apparatus and nobody can move around. If we need like a tower ladder put in one particular position, or hook a ladder laid into a building or something like that. You know, I thought, my God, these guys, these old timers all made sense back then.
So. Speaking of that, if I could, one of the first times I ever heard of getting a good look at the building, well, like a size up, would be, you know, that first aerial device, much like that tower is set up right there. Get somebody up in that basket and get a look from above and get a lay of the land.
Absolutely.
Where the fire is starting to show itself, where it's probably going to go, and what it's going to eat on its way there is really important. You're not going to 360 a half a block. So great way to get information on a big fire is to get above it. And you can only do that with an aerial apparatus.
See, this is one of those fires. You know, these guys who want to talk about a 360, you're never going to get it done. That fire is going to burn down the block by the time you get halfway around this situation, because you have a complex of buildings together. So yeah, that's absolutely right. I've seen that done. You know, I'm sure there's other people who have seen a chief officer go up in a bucket just to do what you said, Jeff, and that is get a lay of the land. You know, that's like getting an aerial view of what's in the path of this thing. So yeah.
Okay. Hey, Jeff.
Yeah.
How many alarms did this fire go to?
It was a 333.
Okay. Where were you at the time? Engine 24?
Yep. So we came in on one of the multiples, and our assignment, and you'll see it here in a little bit, we had, I think it was a third or fourth floor where we took our line into the apartment building and played out the window. And, you know, that was an old tactic, you know. You get a fire coming into a building, you get lines into the building. Well, again, it takes manpower and equipment to get those lines stretched into position, because you want to stop any fire coming in that might come through a window or something like that. If you're there and you're holding control, then we're going to keep that building alive and safe. And that was it. So, and one of the things that strategic fire training teaches, you're going to see it employed here also, and that's a rope drop from the roof where a 2.5 was pulled to the roof. So we'll go over that in a little bit here too. So, you know, it's kind of interesting because Chad and I were talking, and Jeff also separately, that the things that we do in strategic fire training are all experience-based. You know, when we talk about this stuff, when we have the students do it and things like that, you're going to see stuff like this that, you know, we've actually done at fires with success. And, you know, that's important. Rather than just throwing an idea out there and saying, hey, let's try this. Let's see if this works and so forth. And again, that's that stuff about the principles, the practices, the basics, and knowing them and where to apply them. So.
All right, let's see what you got next here, Jeff.
Okay, so.
That must be the north side of the building, the way the wind's blown into it like that.
This is the north side of the building. Yeah, that's correct. Okay, this is Euclid Avenue in front of you, right here, okay? So, guys are taking windows out, and that's one of those things. You know, if you keep the fire inside, well, then you keep the intensity in, and you help the fire actually burn through a lot faster. You see it's already through the roof. See that little orange spot right up there? Right, yeah. By the street light, okay? So what does that create for the fire situation inside? But again, why do we vent? Well, we vent to get that crap out of the building. We vent to lower the temperatures and, of course, make access for the streams. And you're going to see that happening here in a little bit. So, yep. As I said, you know, like the other side of the building, when we were looking at 46th Street, windows were still in. You know, the building being demoed, but they just hadn't gotten to that yet. So, you know how it is when you have a vented fire, how much easier it is to control it. So,
yep.
Yep. Okay. All right, so let's move on here. There you go. Getting a lot of stuff going. Okay. So, yeah, I'm just getting the windows out.
So. Okay.
Now, here's a concern for any firefighter breaking windows like this. Yeah, we were always taught if you're butting a ladder, there's a firefighter on a ladder, and you hear glass breaking, don't look up. You don't want to get a face full of glass. You don't. You know, we've had guys in the past. We've seen people in the past. And this goes for all fire departments. And where the glass shards have come down, they've caught a guy. Before we went to wristlets in our turnout coats years ago, you had a space between the backside of your glove and your coat cuff. Many guys, they either got burned there if the steam got through or during operations like this where you're venting windows, where glass pieces could fall right there, and a lot of guys got cuts on the wrist and things like that. So, but again, that thing, when you hear glass breaking and you know it's overhead, don't look up. Very plain and simple, okay?
You use the brim of that traditionally styled helmet to keep the glass out of your collar. Just
hey, how about that?
Yeah.
Son of a gun. And again, you know, take a look at our turnout gear. You know, you got full protective gear here, but I don't think we were that much into hoods then. But then again, what's a hood going to do? It's not, you know, not for glass. If you get glass in your hood, that's not a good thing for you. So, right. But anyways, yeah. Simple things to remember. Okay. Should we move on?
Yeah, let's go. Yep.
Okay. Okay, so here it goes. Yes, I'm going to move to the next photo. Okay, so it's coming now. Again, we said it's moving from right to left, going down the block. There's something you see in firefighter training schools right there. That firefighter carrying a ladder vertically by himself. Okay, it's doable, as you can see. And again, that's what we talked about a little bit ago, where things that are taught in basic training, you never know when you're going to need it out into the street. So that's one of the things right there, you know, one of the reasons to justify, you know, what we do in basic training. And that's what it's all about. It comes from experience. So.
Yep.
Okay, so they're starting to stretch a couple of lines right here. They're starting to get water from the bucket of the tower, playing it into that one second floor window. Excuse me. And again, the whole goal is to throw as much water at this thing as you can. You know, the supply is not an issue. It's just getting apparatus into place so they can start operating right there.
Yeah, you got the tower operating, at the deck gun still going. It looks like they're getting a 2.5 just started there, huh?
Right. Yep, 2.5. It looks like you're getting water in the fire. Notice all the white steamy smoke. And again, it may be that you are getting water on some of the fire, but there's interior walls that you might have to deal with. Who knows what the conditions are inside? Remember, again, it's a building that's under demolition, so those void spaces and things like that, you know, and piles of debris or whatever inside, you know. But if you think, oh, good, we're getting water in this fire, let's move it around. You know, pick another window. Let's bring the bucket down. Let's shoot the line up into the ceiling space and things like that. See if that does anything. So sometimes it's a real good thing to do, and sometimes it works. Other times, again, you don't know what the circumstances are. Kind of goes back to something we said before about fires being circumstantial. Maybe.
Yeah, absolutely.
So, okay. Okay, here's another tower ladder set up at the other end of the building. Okay, so again, you got the deck gun of that engine down there at 46. You got the bucket. You got a 2.5-inch hand line in operation. Now they're going to put this tower ladder in. to the left of that picture right there, that's the four-story apartment building. As you can see, it's only like 4 or 5 feet away from this building that's on fire. And this fire is coming down here, and we don't want it to knock out these people's homes. My God, it's four stories of old apartments. A lot of older people call that place their home, and we want to stop it. We don't want to see these people lose their home and so forth. So
yeah. So I see the engine there and the tower.
Yep.
Real quick, could you hit the rule of 70s for us? Give a little refresher on that one.
Yeah, the rule of 70s. That's an old hook and ladder thing where 70-foot elevation, 70-degree angle, and what the heck was the third one?
Is that 70 pounds pressure?
Yeah, 70 pounds pressure for that's right, because it's a solid bore. You know, when you're using a ladder pipe, you might as well go with a solid bore because you're saying you've got a big fire. So instead of 80 pounds, which could, you know, some of the old aerial ladders weren't built to today's standards, 70 pounds was a little bit safer operating pressure. So it worked out real well. It was an easy thing to remember. So, yeah, thanks for bringing that up.
Yeah, cool. So,
this is 4-inch supply line, as you see here. Okay, a lot of places, you know, in fact, as we go around the country, we're working with other departments, you see 4-inch, 5-inch, and I know there's been 6-inch out there. I don't know if that's very popular, but we've had 4-inch since 82 that I recall, 81, 82. And in our situation, the 4-inch works very, very well. John, would you say?
Oh, yeah. What did we use before the 4-inch?
We had 3-inch.
3-inch, that's what I was thinking. Yeah.
That's what a lot of departments, again, that, I'm going to hit back on Project Fires. All this stuff was in consideration and being tested back in the 70s. You know, we were going to increase the size of hoses. We're going to increase the volume of attack. We're going to take a look at nozzles, turnout gear, SCBAs, procedures, everything. And so I've said it before many times when in the early, I think it was 81 or 82, we got brand new hose. So we had brand new all 1¾-inch. That was the smallest diameter hose that we were going to use for fire attack. 2-inch, 2½, and then supply line 4-inch. And in our situation, our hydrants are like 250 feet apart. And for relay operations, they work very well. They did their homework, I got to say. Our people did, you know, about 4-inch, because some people thought, well, why didn't you go to 5? Well, because we have 4 people on an engine. We expect 4 people to do this. And when it comes to relay or supplying, other situations, towers and deck guns and things like that, it works very well. So, you know, I think that was a good thing, and it's worked very well. Now, I'll say another thing here. If you take a look close, when we get a close-up picture of the pump panels, like you see that engine over there, he's got 4-inch coming off the large diameter discharge, coming around here, wrapping around and going into the intake of the tower ladder. Those are threaded couplings. And we got those back in the mid-90s because we originally had stores couplings. And, you know, we just we didn't have that great of luck with them. I'll say that.
The early 90s did not have the locking coupling.
We didn't have good luck with them.
Yeah, and if you didn't lay them out flat, when they would charge up, they would roll over and, you know, they'd come undone.
Absolutely. Yeah, and let's say, like in our situation, like you heard me say, our hydrants are 250 feet apart. So for your day-to-day operations, our first engine goes right in, and we'll start stretching a line and operate it off the tank. And the premise is that pump operator, once he gets that first line set with the pump, he can start stretching to a nearby hydrant. And that's the whole thing. It's like almost like a timed evolution. And if we're fortunate enough to be between two hydrants that are 250 feet apart, we'll go do the math and figure out what the length of your layout is. So if you have storage couplings back then that were twisting the hose and or the hose was twisting and causing the couplings to come apart, you weren't going to get a water supply from your hydrant unless you had to go back and get some help and shut it off.
Redo it.
Exactly. So like I said, when they went to the threaded couplings, number one, they made it easier. Our threaded couplings go directly on the hydrant.
Yeah, and it's only three full turns, and it's on.
Yeah, that's it. Yeah. Once you get the thread started, you're not going to cross-thread it, and you're going to be secure. So that's worked very well for us. Right, Mr. Mateer?
Yeah. You know what else I was noticing? You're talking about the water supply and how it's not an issue for us. They're supplying the bucket up there, and they also have the 2.5 off this apparatus.
Yeah, I think that's going down the street.
Looks like it's the one going in the window right there on the right side of the picture.
Now, see, this is one of the things that we do when we're going out and showing people a low pressure, high volume system. So, you know, what do you got about? Well, I'm just going to say that the line was probably 200 feet long, the 2.5. You can see it coming right off the outlet of the pump right there. So let's say it's 200 feet. Because they had some, see how it's draped behind them on the street?
Yeah.
What's the pressure you need? 50 at the nozzle, and then 5 or 6 pounds per 50-foot length. So if you got 4 or 5 of those laid out, so you're looking at, you're in a 75 to 80 PSI pump discharge range. Take a look what's going into the tower. Okay. And they got their own supply, or they got the supply coming in, then they got their own, you know, pumping unit, and they'll take that and they'll be sufficient.
That makes the world of difference, to keep it simple, you know.
Oh yeah. Keep your firefighting simple. How about that? What a concept. So
what's the next slide?
Right here. Okay, that's coming. So we've got in this, we've added an aerial device in there. What's that? 2-2.
I see 3 aerials now.
Yep, exactly. So notice the positioning. Again, these are the things that, you know, you got to keep in mind. So if you got a fire that's going to overtake an old building, is there a chance of possible collapse? If the roof goes in, can it cause the upper part of the walls to buckle outwards? So don't put your personnel or your apparatus in a situation where they can get, firefighters can get injured, God forbid anything else worse, and your apparatus, you want to protect that also. So if you got a big thoroughfare, and you got the water and you got the pumping capacity, hey, put them in a position where you can, have them do their job from a little bit safer operating zone.
Hey, boss.
Yeah.
I know we talk about this quite a bit when we go around the country, the weight of water. Did you guys experience any water problems coming, walls collapsing or filling up the basement, or any thought of that?
You're talking about from the fire, that's a prolonged operation that you're talking about?
Yeah. You know, when we talk about when we're pumping this water inside these buildings, put the fire out, and then knowing the weight of water and where that water is going, did you guys have any sidewalls push water weight out? And did you experience anything like that?
You know, I'm willing to bet it's happened, because I know it's happened in many other places. Yeah, you got a fire like this, and it's going for a while. You're dumping thousands of gallons a minute into this joint. The fire is weakening the building, and I think that's why you once again, if you've got the ability, you put your apparatus back and your personnel back too, and so forth, because there is that history, there is that chance. So I don't know. I'm sure we've had something like that, you know. And many other departments have too.
All right, next slide, and then I got a question for you, Jeff.
Yeah, go ahead. You want me to move?
Yeah, go ahead and move it, and then I'll fire it at you. So as far as, you know, engine operations, you know, as you get there on that initial alarm, three engines, two trucks and a rescue. As you arrive on the scene, you take in for the first assignments. I mean, you're trying to figure out, okay, this building's on fire, but where's our advantage of attack here? You pick in a corner, trying to get on a side of it, whether you're going to stretch in or go heavy streams from outside.
Right.
You mentioned water supply is not much of an issue. When you get in further into the alarm, second, third, and you're staging in, what's some of the things as an engine crew that you're thinking of as you're riding across town? You're like, yo, man, this thing's going multiple alarms. We're probably going to be doing X, Y, Z. You know, what's some of the things that are going through your mind as you arrive on that second or third alarm?
All right. First of all, when you're going in on the box, it's most likely in a situation like this, you don't have this magnitude on arrival. All right. So the fire still gaining headway. And when you arrive, you got workers on the scene. What do you think they're going to be telling you when you get out of the cab? The fire's down here. The fire's down here. Here, you got to get in here and put it out, you know? And in a lot of cases, you know what firemen are going to do. They're going to try to stretch a line in and put the fire out. And they are already on a tactical channel. As multiple alarms are struck, second alarm, third alarm, fourth alarm, or however many alarms you're going to, first thing, when you get dispatched, you got to go to that tactical frequency because you do not self-assign. And I had one of my old captains from those days. Let me go back here. He wised me up to that. As a young fireman, all full of piss and vinegar, you know, hey, let's, you know, you're picking up at one and going to another and so forth. And no. He says, no. We wait to be dispatched. You do not self-assign. That's a discipline of the job. So when I hear all these departments or these guys who say, oh, yeah, we jumped this one, we jumped that one, and so forth, you know, that's how you get into chaos. And that's how you get into disorganization or lack of discipline, so forth. So from an engine perspective, though, when you're going in, you make sure the first thing is that you got your radios on the same frequency. So you're hearing what's going on. You don't self-assign. You don't pick an area of the building and decide to do what you want, because now you're freelancing. And you're working against what may be the overall plan of the incident. So when we got here, we were coming in command. And this is the whole thing about a command post. In this type of fire operation, you have to have a formalized command post, because they're keeping a list of who the companies are, where they're working, and what they're doing. So when you get there, like in our case, they said, no, we need you guys. You guys are taking a line into this apartment building. That was our job. So we stretched the line. We reported over to that engine right there, stretch an inch and three quarter out the line, up the stairs. Like I said, I think we were in either the third or the fourth floor in that joint. And we were operating our line out the window. So, and then, you know, that's accountability. Once again, that's accountability. That's crew concept. That's teamwork. And by the way, if you have 12 or 15 engines operating a fire like you would in this case, you all have to be operating under the same game plan. Again, it's teamwork. Same thing with the trucks or the aerial devices. So funny, because as before we started, you know, remember I showed you these books, you know, by Clark, Firefighting Principles and Practices, first and second editions. And the first thing he says in there, one of the early parts of the section on major fire operation, he says, you can be good at the regular fires, but in these fires, you have to be better at controlling your resources. Too easy for guys to freelance or get lost or something like that.
Yeah, for sure.
So
discipline.
Yeah. So, okay. Move on.
Yep.
Okay. There we go. Yeah, see, it's not getting any better. Okay, so now we got, you know, several master streams on this side of the building, okay? And again, you see that on the left side of the picture right there. It's one, two, three, four, probably a 4 or 5 story building. And between that building there and the corner of this building that's going is that 4-story apartment building. So, all right. So, and notice the changing in the characteristics of the smoke. Okay.
Yeah, that gas-fed fire is having a good old time with that building. Oh, that's for sure.
Yeah.
It's just going until utilities gets there and shuts off that main or shuts off that line. Yeah, it's like you said, having a good old time. So, okay. Yeah, now it's getting a little bit smokier.
Okay.
All right. There we go. Yeah, bring your buckets down, bring your aerial devices down, and again, horizontal attack from an upper level, even though, you know, that's,
Hey, boss.
Yes.
I know that, you know, the photographer, and he did a great job on this. You know what? I've only seen one of so far, which kind of talks about your placement. There aren't any engines in this picture.
Uh-uh. No.
There aren't any engines that I've seen on this, but I've seen one so far.
Yeah, exactly. Engines, get them out of the way of the buildings. You know, you can put them off to the corners. You can always pull extra hose. You can always add an extra length or two if you have to for your supply lines, or excuse me, for your attack lines. And you see, there you go. You're recognizing that. And you're talking about engine placement. Departments that have nothing but pre-connected lines, you know what they're doing. They're positioning their apparatus as close to the fire building as they can because they only got 200 feet to work with. And that's the thing. If you got buildings like this, you've got the potential for something like this, and it's not going to be, you know, relying on 200-foot pre-connects. Telling you that.
Yeah. If you do that with something like this, you're adding a very expensive exposure to this fire.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, absolutely. This looks like another 2.5 waiting to be charged. So, okay.
Yeah. Go to the next one here.
Okay, here we go. Yeah.
Another good shot.
Yeah. Flood it out. Flood it out because you're not, this is all exterior. I don't know if you, whatever, you know, it's exterior operations, you know.
Yeah.
This building's gone. It was already scrapped out and so forth. And again, talking about firefighter safety and so forth, my God. You know, just use what you got to contain it, confine it.
Yeah. Do the pictures further down the road, do they go in around that other side where the apartment building and that hotel are?
Yeah, okay. We do. Yep, you see it. It's getting a little smoky now.
Yeah. Can't see the building at all.
No.
And that's the windward side.
Yeah, it is. Yeah.
I have a feeling it's about to change drastically.
Yeah, it's just Mike. Can't even see anything anymore. So.
Oh, yeah, here it comes.
Yeah, it's coming. So. Play away.
Yeah, it's looking pretty angry.
Oh, yeah. Okay. So. And now it's coming through the roof. So, you know what that's going to do when it comes through the roof. What it's going to do with those windows out, those windows may let air in to feed the cocklaw fire and coming out the roof. It's almost like a chimney effect.
Right.
So there again, get your streams up in there and get that water in there. And hopefully that draft effect will help carry some of that into that area. So that's the other thing about streams. I remember this is Clark in his books, especially Firefighting Principles and Practices, the first edition, talked about if the master stream is just set up in one location, let's say you set up a ground mount and you're throwing water into a window. Let's just say it's going into a window where you see fire, that middle window right there. And the fire darkens down. Well, what do? You know, people will look at it and let it run all night long. You move it. Move it for a better vantage into the fire. And in so many cases, you see streams set up for master stream buckets, ladder pipes, and things like that. And all they're doing is throwing water on something that's already extinguished, or you're throwing water on charcoal. So move it. Be mobile with your streams and so forth. Just like when you're doing a hand line attack. Go in, move your stream around, right? Isn't that what we teach the guys to do? Well, it's the same thing with these things. You know, move them window to window, up and down, side to side, things like that. If you got that mobility, you know, you got it with the bucket, or if you got a deck gun operating off from an engine, yeah, try to sweep it every once in a while. You know, so see what it does.
Yeah, keep it rolling.
Right. There we go. Well, look at the smoke.
Yeah, you can tell it's coming out the roof now.
It's exactly. See, that's the thing about the wind is it's drawing in now. Okay. So funny how that thing about ventilation got screwed up, you know, in how to understand it.
Right. Jeez. Especially on a huge building fire like this.
Oh my God.
And,
yes.
You know, typically the problem is there's no points to ventilate from, and it's, you got to wait for it to burn through before you can do anything. But hey, at least you had some advantage there with getting those windward sides out and way to get the streams into the building.
Yeah. Well, again, you know, let's take a look at the two reasons we vent. Number one is for life. Number two is for fire. So as we said before, you know, life safety, not a concern here. And I know there's going to be some safety Nazi out there. Oh, there's always a concern. Yeah, we get it. Okay, don't worry. We know what we're talking about here when we say that, okay? No, what I'm talking about is you vent for the fire in this case because you want to minimize the amount of heat buildup, because that heat buildup, again, like we said earlier, is allowing that fire to spread quickly. You're keeping all that in. So it's just, you know, you're freight trading it in there. And by opening up those windows, taking them out, you're releasing some of the heat. Now you got access for streams to go in. So, and again, what's our goal? To stop this fire from knocking out the rest of the block. So there we go.
There's easy 2,500 gallons a minute right there in that picture. Easy.
Oh God. At least. So, how about that?
It's a good picture.
Yeah, no engine over 100 PSI.
Gee, how about that?
That's
how
great.
Does that work, people ask? Well, it works pretty well.
Yeah.
So, if you have a low pressure system, and again, this is per fire department. You know, again, when we go out and we talk about low pressure, high volume, we have an engine that's pumping over 1,500 gallons a minute through maybe a deck gun or a ram, a 2-inch or a couple of 2-inch hand lines, a 2.5-inch hand line, and so forth. And we move it around and so forth. But when you tell people, we didn't have to go over 100 PSI, the engine had to work to push this water out of this engine at that volume, at that pressure. But take a look at what we have. And then they look at you like, golly, how does that happen? So forth. So point being, if you're working on a fire and you realize you got 50 PSI nozzles, whether they be solid bore or fog, if you got 50 PSI nozzles, you've got master stream set up, and you start hearing those engines revving up, you should know that pump operator needs to be throttling down rather than up. And again, take a look at your water supply here. You got a great water supply. So whatever comes into your pump, that engine really doesn't have to work that hard, you know, to create that volume and that pressure needed for delivery, right?
That's key. Yeah.
Yeah. So, like I said, you know, like what we pass on, these are those little things that you learn over time, watch for, things like that. So, all right. By the way, this is about 2005, and we went to Black Turnout here in 2007. Great move. Everybody loved it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Not that, yes. Not that y'all used it on this, but 2005, that's pre-RAM. So RAMs were not available for you at this point.
Not at all. Not at all. John, when did the RAMs come in? After I left or what?
Yeah, it was after you left. I'm not really sure, was it? I lose track of time. We've had them for probably 7 or 8 years at least.
Okay. All right.
And probably one of the better pieces of equipment they bought our department since I've been on.
Oh, absolutely.
I love that. I love that tool. It works really good.
Tell everybody what you told me or the guys were doing like at 11 with the RAM. What did they do? Put it in a 2.5-inch attack line?
In the hose bed?
Yeah.
Yeah, a lot of them are just pre-connecting it in the 2.5 bed. and that's how they roll, and they'll take it off and add the play pipe if that's what they need, but their first thought is to go with the RAM. So
go big, kill it. I love it.
Definitely won't hurt anything doing that.
No.
Well, how about that? Keep it simple. Go in with a big cannon.
So right. All right, what else can we get out of this side of the view here, Jeff? If maybe advance a couple of slides here.
Yeah, let's go here. Okay. Yeah. This picture right here, this is something that you learn over time handling a 2.5. And really, everybody needs to practice with their hand lines, regardless, you know. Very simple thing. Have 100 feet in your hose of hose in your apparatus bay, 100, 150, I don't care. But just stretch it out, flow it on a daily thing, wash your apparatus floor down. I don't care what you do with it, you know, but get the feel of operating with that line. This is a friend of mine from Columbus Fire, Jimmy Pritzel, many years ago, was looking at a picture of a fire in Cleveland. And he says, take a look at this. Those guys got that 2.5 stretched out so well. And see, this is what we talk about. Notice how straight it is behind the nozzle. Yep. And he noticed that. That was a fire from back in the early 70s. He says, man, you guys had that stuff figured out back then. And see, this is the thing about the job and training with your hose lines and your equipment on a regular basis. So when it comes to a time like this, you stretch it out, keep it straight. As we always tell the students when we're out doing classes, that force now is being directed back down through the hose into the ground. And it's something simple right there that two guys can handle. One of the things we also used to do, we used to take a 6-foot pike pole, bring it back behind the nozzle about 5 feet back, take a Houd strap. We all have Houd straps. And it's like a 5-foot long piece of 1-inch nylon. And it has different loops in it. And the whole idea was to put the pike pole underneath the hose, take your Houd strap, lash it to the hose, and two guys can sit there like in a situation like this. And they hold on to the pike pole, and the nozzle's right out in front of them, and they just direct it and play away, and there's hardly any back pressure at all. So nothing to deal with anyhow.
Right.
So, yeah. But, yeah, just that simple picture right there shows a real nice thing about how you keep your hose line straight. Don't put bends behind your nozzles, because that nozzle's going to want to react.
Makes total sense, yeah.
Yeah. Okay, there we go. So, all right. Very good. Play away, gentlemen. Yeah, it's coming this way, as you can see it through the rope. It's still, you know.
That's all it has left to eat now is the roof.
Right.
I would just keep advancing here.
Yeah. Yep. That right there, by the way, that line on the left. Let's go back here. See this gentleman by himself on a hose line?
Yeah.
Okay. That's probably 2-inch hose, because for the longest time, we were having automatic nozzles on that. And, you know, one of the things we found out was that a 2-inch line with an automatic nozzle wasn't that great of a fit. So this is pre-low pressure for the 2-inch lines.
Okay.
So that was an automatic tip, you know, by a manufacturer, obviously. And the flows that we were getting from 2-inch with automatic nozzles was not doing any better than 1¾ that we had on the engines. And I did write a thing at that time. I was thinking 2-inch, my God, it's a loser. You know, it's one of those things that misleads our thinking. Guys are thinking, oh, I'm throwing too much or all this water, you know, with the 2-inch line and so forth. And, you know, then when we started doing the classes and putting the flow meters on the lines and the different sizes and so forth, it was like, holy cow, you know. So going to low pressure nozzles on a 2-inch line, that's when we found out, like, oh my God, what a difference.
Yeah, that's the difference.
Yeah, absolutely. That's when we started seeing the value of the 2-inch line. And that was increased flow, low pressure, and mobility.
Yeah.
Because as we say, you know, you got about 68 pounds of water weight in a 50-foot length of 2-inch hose. Why, what's not to like about that? Especially if you're moving that line about and going in with it and things like that. So, you know, let's make this line work for us. And that's what happened. So we didn't look at that. So, yeah. Right, John?
See if,
yeah. Go on. Who is that?
I was just going to say, let's see if we can advance the slides to get into a different time frame of the fire here. Maybe we can go a little bit further and down the road here.
Okay.
And Steve did a really nice job photographing this, that's for sure.
I know there are some cool pictures coming up from the – oh, there you go. We're here.
Yeah, there you go. And this once again, is what we have done with students in the past. There's that four-story apartment house. And like I said earlier, it was probably 4 to 5 feet away from the east wall of this building. So the idea, that's not a line on the roof. I'm sorry, that's a tower ladder operating in the back.
Mm-hmm.
That's a bucket up there. Okay, you'll see in a second here. Okay, so there you see a couple of guys up on the roof there of the apartment building. You see them?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay.
So right there, I'm going to take the cursor. Can you guys see my cursor?
Yes.
Okay, right here is the rope drop. Okay. And they're going to get a 2½ up to the roof.
Ah, yeah, here it comes off the back of the engine.
And there they are playing away.
Yeah.
So right there they are. So we had lines on the roof, lines in this area right here playing out. So we must have been on the fourth floor on this one. And again, you're trying to throw up a wall of water. So from a strategic standpoint, remember your strategy is your overall plan. The whole idea is, you know, if you want to follow what Emmanuel Freed put out there many years ago, locate, confine, extinguish. And we'd like to say locate, confine, extinguish, and kill it. Because if we don't, we can try to extinguish it, but if we're not doing a good job of it, then we're just playing with it, and it's playing with us, and we don't want to lose that. So locate, confine, let's go kill it. That'll be our third thing right there. So throw up that wall of water and save the property, save lives, and so forth. So, okay. This, by the way, it was an old building. And again, you as you went into this place, it had a lot of people lived there for many, many years. And, you know, you just got a sense that this is somebody's home, you know. Oh, it's actually many people's homes right here. those apartments. That's what they represent. So
yeah,
do your best to protect it and save it. So that's pretty good.
Oh, you can see the engines finally.
Yeah.
And they say that we don't ever compliment trucks.
How about that? Well, we say they're nice guys.
They're usually outstanding.
Yep. I don't know. Tactical engine. That guy had been moved down, by the way.
Yeah. I would think he was on the initial corner.
Right. And see, that's that whole thing about, you know, if you got to move your apparatus, move your equipment, move your deck guns or whatever, well, do them, you know. So if it makes sense, it's going to help you get fire control. Yeah. Okay, there's a close-up shot of that, that 4-inch with the threaded coupling right there. So it's a 2.5-inch outlet with 3-inch plumbing behind it. And because you've got male and female threads on your LDH, well, then you got to have the appropriate adapters to go with it. So that's one of the things they did. Once again, it was a good idea. When we got supply hose with threaded couplings and everybody got new adapters citywide for it to go with it. So, well, that's it. All comes with knowing your equipment.
Yeah.
So, yeah. And there you go.
There's a supply down the street.
And that's the backside. And that's that bucket that you saw just a few slides back.
Oh, yeah, over the 4-story building.
Right. That's the 4-story building on the right there. So, see, so we mentioned strategy, the overall plan. Yeah, you know, determine what is the goal here or what are the goals. There could be several goals that we have to achieve. And your tactics are those steps taken to satisfy the goals. There's nothing secretive about this and nothing scientific about it. You got a building that's going to hell, and if we don't stop it, if we don't get in front of it, it's going to knock out that building to the right, and it's going to continue on down the block. And we don't want that to happen. So that's where fire department, you know, as you got a big department, you got a whole bunch of resources, personnel, apparatus, equipment, for God's sake, get them to these fires and get them moving quickly early on, as Stapleton would say, you know, quick succession of calls, stage them and then give them their orders when they get there, where you want them. So, and I know according to, you know, command and all that stuff, you might get orders en route where to set up your apparatus. So that's another reason why we said earlier, you know, as soon as you get the call, you're going, well, you better get your radios on that tactical frequency and so you can listen in for any possible orders while en route. So,
yeah.
Yeah. See if I got any more here. Oh, yeah. Yeah, this is part of the complex right here. So you can see how those windows were, this is along 46th Street here. And here again, you had that little alleyway there. And this big building here, used to love it, man. You get those big fires afterwards, you know, you got the debris all over the place and you've got cinders and you've got stuff all over the place. And, you know, watch this. You can't see too much there. There we go. Let's see, again, you're trying to keep the building or keep that fire in that building of origin. You know, that's a strategic concern right there.
Sure.
So here, I think, okay. Let's see here. 909 ladder. This is that corner.
Oh, yeah, that's from the like first slide.
Yep.
Now we're full circle here now.
Yep. Right. So, and of course, Chief's doing what they do. Talk to people.
Yeah. Keep the shine on those shoes, though. They're nice.
Oh, yeah. So, that's a great photo right there. So,
Yeah, I mean, these big operations, I think they bring so many things to the table for us. One is just first arriving, you got to be able to downshift a little bit and just keep yourself under control and realize, let's think bigger strategic plan versus our get in as far in and as hot and wet as we can go. When you have a multiple alarm job developing in front of you, you have to be thinking more about how do we supply the big lines? Are we where we need to be to do that? And obviously fall in line with the overall strategic plan that command comes up with.
Well, I'm going to throw something out to you right now. I know we've discussed it before. And it's this whole thing about the 360. Yes, you heard that. That crack of the cam. Anyways, you know, whose responsibility is a 360? And this goes back to Warren Kimball. And he did his work back in, oh my God, I want to say the 30s, the 40s, the 50s, the 60s. And he always talked about the truck boss being the combat engineer. Now, we said earlier in this presentation that if you're going to do a 360 on a situation like this, this place is going to burn the block down and you're going to be about halfway around the block. And so if you have a department that has engines and ladders and you have a situation like this, the engine has to maintain crew concept. That company officer on the engine or that acting officer on the engine has got to be with his crew. And most likely, we said this earlier also, most likely you're going to stretch an attack line. Unless it's one of those fires that's, you know, it's balls on the wall fire, and you're going to sit back and you're going to determine where are we going to start from first, okay? But that truck that's coming in a situation like this, and you just hit it right in the head, and that's what made me think of it, Jeff, these slow-to-develop fires. Here's the situation you had here. You had a hell of a fire situation that was complex, but it was developing at that time. And that's why initial alarm, the initial alarm was struck, but then subsequent multiple alarms were struck to get more resources in there. So you just can't have people doing things helter-skelter and so forth and don't act quickly. You got to see the bigger picture. And again, you see, when I go back here, let me go back here. Look at this complex. This is what you didn't see earlier as we were focused on Euclid Avenue mostly and what was going on there. When you have this old industrial building right next door to it, and I think it was attached in the back there. Let's go back a little bit right here. So, you know, there is that thing about the fire and its location within the building, which way it's going. And if the fire gets out of the building, what are the exposures there? So who is going to put together that information, you know? And again, yeah. I'm falling back on Kimball where he says, truck boss. And you brought up a good thing early on about use the bucket, get the chief up there if you want, or an officer, a company officer who can report to the chief that, hey, this is what we got, this is where it's going, and, you know, so forth. This is what we need to do. Stuff like that. Everybody working together with one attack plan.
So. Yep, always super important.
Yeah.
Well, this is a good walk around Euclid in 46. Thanks, Jeff.
Well, it's still there.
So. I think we wore Dino out.
Yeah, I think
I'm going to have to work on his conditioning a little bit.
He's only been.
That's the chief and his aide. Happy faces.
Yeah, fireman humor is never far away. Look at that.
Yeah, really.
Good times.
Okay.
Kid must have forgot to wash it that morning.
Yeah right. No.
Hey, Jeff, you know, one thing I noticed, yeah, we kind of touched on it a little bit, but the placement of those apparatus, for as many apparatus as there were going down Euclid Avenue, it was still pretty wide open.
Oh, Euclid Avenue. Yeah, go on.
But, I mean, there was five or six apparatus, aerial apparatus, stretched out along there. And it wasn't crowded at all.
No. How about that? Now, there's probably some cities, I think Chicago has hose wagons. And I think they got two of them. At least I recall they did it one time recently. I used to get a magazine, Fire Apparatus Journal, and they would chronicle fire departments and what their apparatus rosters had on them and new purchases that fire departments were making. And the whole idea is that you get a fire like this, if you've got a waterway nearby, you got a fireboat, you can call it a fireboat and have one of these hose wagons. You know, a lot of departments put big deck guns, far beyond 2-inch tip capabilities, on their hose wagons. And they can lay right out from the fireboat and lay down, oh, heck, however much hose they got.
Right. Yeah. Lay down like a whole new city main right on top of the street.
That's what it is, yeah.
Let it rip.
Sometimes they have manifolds built where they can set up a manifold right out in the street and other engines or towers can tap off of them. So, yeah. So.
Well, thanks for sharing this, Jeff. I when you have a chance to, in your career to go to a big fire like this, there's always lessons to take. And when you go to two or three or four of them, you start to see the principles coming through. One is placement. Another big part of it is communicating a plan and going with it. And the other is it taking in the information that the building will give you and using it to your advantage, using the surrounding buildings to your advantage if you have to, much like at this fire. With that, I mean, what other takeaways am I missing here?
Well, that thing about vetting the windows. Making access for your streams like you see here right now. I know it's after the fire is pretty much burned out, but getting, you know, again, knowing the building, knowing your neighborhood, knowing the things like your water system, and then to getting the apparatus in there early on and then putting it in the right positions to surround this fire and then cut it off and kill it.
Yeah, and the photos show that, you know, you had an aerial, sometimes two aerials on each corner, you know, with those large caliber streams playing away with the engines supplying away from the building.
Sure.
So, yeah.
Yeah, you know, I don't even want to go down this rabbit hole right now, but, you know, some people are afraid to walk up to a building like this. Well, anything can happen. Okay, you can get hit by a bus walking across the street. That doesn't mean you don't walk across the street. But same thing in a fire. If we got to vent these buildings to get streams into the fire, well then let's do it. Let's have somebody watch out for whatever, if there's anything unsafe about it or what have you. But in the meantime, get things in position. So that's that thing about having a sense about where this fire is going. This fire went from right to left. So you want to vent it to slow it down. You want to get heavy streams on it to slow it down and bring it down even more. You want to put heavy streams. So you got a right side of the picture, you got a bucket overhead. Left side of the picture, you still got a bucket working into this one area right here. And you got a deck there. Just that's it. Throw up that water. Now, what we did over here, as you saw, we had the bucket in the background on the other side of this building. Then you had the 2.5 on the roof. Then we had lines inside. And again, that's all part of that thing about getting people in positions from a strategic standpoint. And those are the tactics that you're going to employ. So,
great stuff, Jeff.
Mr. Gruber.
Yes, sir.
Do you concur?
Yes, sir. Absolutely. I think it was really cool seeing, you know, like I said, I know we don't talk about truckies that often, but they did some really good stuff. They got those ladders down low and got them into the windows.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that's, yeah. Yep. Okay.
All right. I think that wraps up today's episode. We got at least a good hour and 20 minutes so on this fire here with Jeff.
Wow.
Good lessons taken here. When you're going to a big fire, use big water. Make way for the big streams and stay out of the clap zones, fellas. Micah, John, you want to round us out here?
Jeff, I think you covered everything I was going to say there. So,
yeah. All right, good enough. Hey, well, folks, go ahead, Jeff.
It's only taken us like 8 months of doing this show. Want to let everybody know we do have a new email, strategicfiretraining@gmail.com. And it goes to actually all six of us. Knapp wasn't here tonight, but he gets it too. So all of us can check it. So if you have anything you want to go over on the show or any questions about the show, email us at strategicfiretraining@gmail.com.
All right, right on. You can catch us on our website and also the Facebook page. Love to hear from you. And we'll see you out on the interweb, all right?
That's right.
All right, so thanks again for tuning in. And this is Strategic Fire Training signing off.
Good night.
Good night.